All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon. Welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and we're very excited to have you here listening to our program today. We've got some great guests, starting with Vietnam storyteller Tim O'Brien. I'm really excited for you to listen to his story. He's got a new documentary coming out here called The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien. We've got Tim and the director of the documentary, Aaron Matthews, on the program. And in addition to that, we're also going to be talking with Phil Whitloff of the Michigan War Dog Memorial. So we've got a lot of things going on today. And before we get into that, I want to make sure that we thank our sponsors. This portion of Veterans Radio is being brought to you by Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans specializes in veterans' disability claims. Call Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800. Also, the National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, go to their website, nvbdc.org. So without further ado, we are going to get right into the interview right now with Tim O'Brien and Aaron Matthews. Here we are on Veterans Radio, and today we're going to be talking with one of the heroes of the Vietnam generation, and that is Tim O'Brien. And Tim, of course, is the writer of The Things That They Carried, or The Things They Carried, 1990. He's written a lot about his experiences in Vietnam throughout the years, and then he suddenly decided that maybe he should have a family. And having a family kind of changed his life entirely, and that's what we want to talk about today. His new book is Daddy's Maybe Book, and also a documentary that's coming out on the 2nd of March, and that's called The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien. And so joining us on Veterans Radio today, we have the Tim O'Brien. So, Tim, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's really good to talk to you. And also joining us on the line is a producer, director of the documentary, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien, and that is Aaron Matthews. Aaron, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks so much, Dale. It's a pleasure.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, this has been a true honor for me to have the opportunity to talk to both of you about Tim and about his work, because it really hit home. As I was preparing for the interview today, I reread The Things They Carried, and I started reading the Daddy's Maybe book. And Tim, can you tell us about how you started writing the Daddy's Maybe book?
I had late in life my first child, and then 2 years later, a second. I was in my late 50s, and I'm now 74 with two teenagers. I began really by thinking, when my boys grow up, they may never know their father. I might be dead. At that age, people do die. And I wanted to leave something behind for them where they would know at least a little about me, my time in Vietnam, my own childhood, and the great pleasure that I had in being the father of two great little boys. So it began as a kind of gift or a birthday present for my kids, and blossomed from a single 3-page kind of letter that I tucked away in a drawer into a full book. Aaron Matthews, whom I met early on in this process on another project, he was doing a PBS film on the draft, visited me. We became friends. He hounded me. Can I do this film on you? I was reluctant, but Aaron was very persuasive. And we ended up spending the next 4 or 5 years together as he followed the course of my writing the book. He would come and visit for sometimes a day or two, sometimes for a couple of weeks. And we became really close friends, which is really one of the great results of the film. It's a beautiful, beautiful film. He managed to extract whatever drama there is in the life of a writer, which is damn little, you sit in front of a computer all day and type, and that's not exactly, you know, Sly Stallone sort of Rambo stuff. But he found the personal struggle in trying to write about a war and trying to write another book, Dad's Maybe book, that is partly covers the war in Vietnam, and made a really beautiful film that I hope people will watch.
Well, I would certainly encourage him to watch it. I had the privilege of watching it myself, and it was very, very powerful, only because I can relate to many of the things in your life, Tim. I'm also 74, Vietnam veteran. I did have my child a little bit sooner than you did, but it's still the idea of what is going to be our legacy to our children. And I thought that was one of the themes that ran through the documentary as I was watching you sit in front of your computer trying to write. And I guess I could ask you this question. I've had the opportunity to interview many, many writers on Veterans Radio, but it is hard to write a book. I watched you suffering trying to pick out the right words.
Yeah, that's one of the great virtues of Aaron's film, is that it does show an audience that books are made, and they're made the hard way, with parking yourself day after day in front of a computer, even though you may want to be playing baseball or golf or having a drink with friends. You have to do it. The sitting down is so important, and there are many times when you don't want to. And there are also many times when you do sit down and nothing much comes. You can't find words that are sufficient, that are good enough, fresh enough, that convincing enough. And I thought Aaron beautifully captured the struggle. Most often when I read books, I don't think about the labor that went into them. And we shouldn't, as readers. We shouldn't. Our attention should be on what's happening in the story and the characters. And it should seem effortless. But that effortlessness is a kind of a mirage or an illusion, because underneath a story, there's the hard work of putting one letter of the alphabet in front of the next, you know, and so on for 350 pages.
Well, I can only imagine when you started writing it. In the documentary, you talk about wanting to be a writer almost from day one, and that your father had kind of had a lost dream of being a writer as well. Could you address that just briefly?
Well, he did. Yeah, he was also a veteran, in his case of World War II. He was in the Navy aboard a destroyer at Iwo Jima in Okinawa. You know how terrible that was with kamikaze attacks going on then. It was terrifying. My dad couldn't swim, among other things, so... You know, if the ship went down, he went down. And yet he wrote about it in a chipper, kind of Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, old-time movie kind of, you know, on-the-town sort of way, without self-pity and without any writing about what terrified him. He was terrified of dying in the South Pacific. But he did. He was a terrific writer of a certain kind. He wrote fluidly and gracefully and humorously about his experience. I didn't find much humor in my experience in Vietnam. I found pretty much the opposite of. I didn't find much to laugh at.
No, I can agree. I can agree with that. That's just amazing what you just said about your dad, because my father was in the Coast Guard. And he was also on Iwo Jima and at Okinawa. But at Okinawa, his LST got hit by a kamikaze, and he ended up in the Pacific Ocean for a while.
And, no kidding.
And never told me a word about the story at all. And until I started doing this program, and this isn't about me. I'm sorry to go off on a direction here. But
oh, no. Go on.
But the... We did a program on a Coast Guard one day, and my board operator calls into my headphones and says, "Dale, we got this really old guy on the phone." And I'm going, "Okay, we'll put him through. This is great." You know, and he says, "Hi, Dale, how are you? I knew Bill." And I'm going, "Who's Bill?" And he says, "No, I knew your dad, because my dad's name was William Clifton, and he went by Cliff. I didn't know Bill at all. And so he told me what had occurred on that day. And then his son, who was my age, got together and he sent me pictures that I had never seen before and kind of filled in the gaps, because unfortunately my dad died when he was 57. So I was 15 at the time, another older, you know, older dad. And, one of your lines just a minute ago you talked about was that you're not a Sly Stallone and you're not a Rambo guy. And that was one of the things that so many of us struggled with after we came home and we wanted to have our own lives and, you know, put that whole scene behind us. And, you know, and then these movies come out and everybody's a war-crazed Vietnam veteran. But I think that there are more people that are interested in the more thoughtful Vietnam vet. And I think that that's something that I got not only from reading your books, but also from Aaron filming you for his documentary. And I want to ask Aaron a little bit more about that documentary. I can't imagine having somebody follow me around with a camera. I don't even know where I'm going half the time.
Well, Aaron is such a nice human being and such a smart human being that was, sure, what I thought would be really frightening with a camera on me. It was for the first, oh, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. But that last year, no, I'm just kidding. it was always scary. But between shots, Aaron would talk about a whole variety of things. He has children roughly the age of my children. We've gone through a pandemic together. We talk regularly, not even about his beautiful film, but about our lives. And our friendship is one of the monuments that came out of those 4 years. The film is just one monument, and our friendship is another.
Well, I strongly encourage people to watch this. We're talking with author Tim O'Brien and director and producer Aaron Matthews of a new documentary called The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien that's going to be dropped, I guess you could say, be available on the 2nd of March. And I'm anxious to have other people see it. I have to probably ran into trouble because I sent the link to a couple of friends of mine. I said, you got to see this.
Great PR. Aaron's happy. Keep doing it.
Yeah. We're going to spread the word a whole lot once we get this all recorded and edited and sent out. But Tim, I wanted to ask you about, you know, you kind of weave the stories of your experiences in Vietnam and then, you know, and then back to your children throughout this documentary, which was, I thought was really well done, Aaron. I want to congratulate you for the way that you were able to tell Tim's story.
Oh, thank you so much, Dale. I feel a little strange now barging in on this conversation because I find it so moving and interesting. I feel like you guys should just take it away. Yeah, I mean, that sense of intimacy that you get is really because of the great generosity and openness of the O'Brien family and their willingness to let me in bed with them for over 4 years and give the general public a sense of what it takes to create something, what war does to you, and also what it's like to just be an American family, which I think is another one of the great takeaways of this film or the aspects of the film that people really appreciate. You know, I think of this as a family film with an awful lot of cursing, but it's a family film nonetheless. You know, you get to see kind of in many ways, a typical American family, you know, struggling to do the things that many American families deal with. And the fact that we have Tim O'Brien kind of elucidating and articulating themes from, you know, basic family issues that we all deal with to the big issues of art and war is, is an incredible blessing.
Well, it certainly is. And again, going back and actually in the documentary is when I guess I learned more about Tim's life. You know, even with the books that I've read over the past, and you know, the struggle you even had reporting into the military. And I can remember being in a similar situation where I got my draft notice, and I said, geez, I don't want to be a, you know, no offense to the guys who are on the ground, but I said, I don't want to be in the infantry. If I've got to go, I got to go. And so I went down and I enlisted into the flight program. But you had a really difficult time deciding whether you were going to go or not. You got within 20 feet of Canada.
Well, not quite literally. That the things they carry is fiction, but in my head, I got within a foot of Canada in my imagination. I thought about it constantly, both before I actually was sworn in. I thought, should I just leave from my hometown and head for Canada? I lived in Minnesota. It was an 8-hour drive from where I lived up to the Canadian border, and I thought about it constantly. And then once I was in the Army, I was stationed at Fort Lewis for basic training and for AIT in infantry. And there I was, you know, 90 miles from the Canadian border. All you had to do was hop a bus, and there goes America. And there goes my life, so it felt. It was a nightmare. It was worse, really, than anything in Vietnam. Vietnam was horrendous. But it was out of my control once I was there. I just tried to stay alive. But going to Canada was in my control. And I came within a whisker of doing it. I went into Seattle on a leave, a weekend pass, and spent that 2 days thinking I was going to get on a Greyhound bus and head for Canada. And I pictured people in my hometown and my mom and dad, what they would say and what they would feel. I come from a very conservative small town, and I could hear people whispering to other people. Did you hear what the O'Brien kid did? The sissy went to Canada. And I could imagine my mom and dad overhearing that in a restaurant, how their eyes would collide, the sadness they would feel. And in the end, I didn't really make a decision to go to the war. My body did it for me. I just felt like I was sleepwalking. And then ended up in Vietnam, thinking even then that something would rescue me, that I could type and maybe they'd make me a clerk. I could drive, maybe they'd make me a driver. But none of that happened. They put a kid, 22 when I arrived in Vietnam, a kid who had hated Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, just hated sleeping in the rain and bugs and dirt and knew nothing about weapons. And the Army, as the Army will do, they put me where I didn't belong. They put me in the infantry, where I had to then learn everything that I had poo-pooed and hated before, just to keep my body alive. And the rest of the war felt like sleepwalking. If anybody is listening who was a foot soldier in Vietnam, you know what it was like, and I don't have to tell you. It was just marching from village to village, then going back to the first village 2 weeks later, and then doing it all over again. There was no sense of destination, a purpose. Like in World War II, we were heading for Berlin, or we were heading for Tokyo. There was a sense of progress. And in Vietnam, for the foot soldier, it was more like going in circles, guys dying along the way, but without a sense of really accomplishing very much. We rarely even saw the enemy. The VC knew the land, and walked into lots of ambushes, snipers, and mostly landmines were blowing us up. I would say 80% of our casualties came from mines, and you couldn't shoot back at a landmine. It wasn't like the war movies we grew up in, where there's an enemy to shoot at. mortar fire coming in on us. So where is it coming from? It's dark. You don't always see the muzzle flashes of a mortar, especially when it's raining, as it did, it seemed almost all the time. So that that's a long answer to your question. And then you come home, and what do you do with all that, a year and that nightmare? And especially, what do you do with it with children, your own kids? What do you tell them? What do you not say? When you mentioned earlier that you hadn't heard from your own father that story, that's kind of how a lot of veterans are, I think, that we don't, we're polite. You don't go to a cocktail party and say, hey, do you want to hear about being, you know, out bobbing in the Pacific Ocean? Nobody wants to hear that, or what it's like to be in Vietnam. It's sort of a simple politeness. You keep your mouth shut. On top of that, you don't really know what to say. Like, where do you start? What story do you tell? Or do you tell any at all? And there's this kind of pressure for silence that a lot of us feel. And for me, I had the great fortune of being a writer, and I could put it on paper without having to bother anybody. And if people wanted to read it, they could. And if they didn't want to, they didn't have to.
We're going to take a real quick break here with our interview, and we will be back after these short messages. So stick around. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran. A close friend, relative, maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio for this next part of our interview with Tim O'Brien and Aaron Matthews. So we'll go right back to that, and here they are. We're talking with Tim O'Brien and Aaron Matthews about their new documentary coming out on the 2nd of March, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien. For all you Vietnam veterans and everybody else out there probably are aware of Tim O'Brien with his 1990 novel, The Things They Carried. And I was thinking about it as you were talking to my mind is flashing to all kinds of different things, but the respect that I developed after the war, which was, I guess, pretty selfish. I don't know. But the respect I have for people that were on the ground. I mean, I would drop you guys off out there, and then I'd go back and, you know, have a beer or whatever it was. And then, oh, something would happen. I'd go back and get you. And then, you know, as you mentioned, a week later, I'd take you back to the same place again. And it was just, you know, repetition over and over again. And as you said, you know, you never went in any particular direction. Everything seemed like you were in a constant circle. I mean, everybody I've talked to said, you know, we should have started down in the Delta and just marched our way to Hanoi and been done with it. But
yeah, that's the attitude of a lot of my guys who served in my unit, that we're walking anyway. Let's straighten it out and, you know, go in one direction. If you're going to walk, let's stop going in circles. Right. On my own part, I wanted to straighten it out. I wanted to head for Paris, not Hanoi.
That's true. I have to throw this little story in there just because it's so weird. I had to, one day they called our unit. I was down in 3 Corps near Long Bend, and they McVee, in their infinite wisdom, told us to take an interior decorator to Da Lat, which is a Vietnamese resort up in Tu Cor, I think it is. And so we took 3 pilots and a crew chief, and, you know, took a little vacation and flew all the way up to Da Lat. Well, this guy started going around to these furniture stores, and, you know, we loaded the cargo haul in the aircraft and flew it back to Saigon to drop it off because some general needed furniture.
Oh, my God.
So, you know,
I'm out of catching too, that story.
they'll probably be at my door shortly. But the point is just the ridiculousness of some of the things that we had, you know, that we had to go through, just to survive that 12 or 13 month tour. And I just admire the way that you were able to take the words and express, I think, what so many of us have felt over the last 50 years. And that's why.
Yeah, a lot of it is myth breaking, there are certain stereotypes, some of which come from like World War II movies of what war is like. And of course, every war is different from the other wars. Vietnam, as I said earlier, there was that absence of purpose and destination. When you're on the ground, politics aren't on your mind. What's on your mind is staying alive and trying to hope you can help your friends stay alive. When I got there in 1969, there were no more thoughts about we're going to win this war, like victory. I don't think any of us expected Ho Chi Minh to say, we quit, we surrender, you won. That was out of the question. It was, by the time I got there, it was a question of trying to keep yourself and your friends alive. And without that mythology of we're going to win this thing, it didn't. But I think we could have probably paved all of South Vietnam and all of North Vietnam and put a big concrete fence around both those places. I still think you can't bomb people out of what they want and what they believe in. Even if you don't believe in it, they did. They were, the Vietnamese, by and large, wanted to run their own country. It was theirs. And so they didn't much care for the Chinese butting in. They didn't much care for the French butting in. And by and large, they didn't care much for the Americans butting in. It was their country. I don't think the people in Sioux City or Des Moines or Boise, Idaho would like it if a bunch of Al-Qaeda people walked into their towns and took over and peed in their wells and killed their chickens and burned down their houses and said, here's what you got to do. We wouldn't like it. And I don't think most of the Vietnamese, at least those in Quang Ngai province, liked it. There was hostility all around us, from the eyes of the children burning into us and the old women howling as we frisked them. And not that kind of cleansed World War II feeling of righteousness and rectitude that my dad had. There was a different ethos to the war in Vietnam. Another thing I'll mention, and I'll shut up, is that Vietnam veterans, like veterans of any war, are not homogeneous. We're not all alike. A lot of my friends think we should have, you know, bombed Hanoi until Hanoi was vapor. Others who were less hawkish, who didn't believe in the war, and just wanted to go home. And then all kinds of grades in between those two extremes. So there's this other myth of sort of the Vietnam veteran is, we're all alike, kind of that Rambo thing you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. You come home and you watch these kind of psycho freaks. And yeah, there were some guys like that, but there were a lot of guys who were thoughtful and quiet, plodded along, just humping, doing what they thought they had to do, and managing somehow to endure it all. And that's what I think most veterans really take the most pride in. We endured. There was right. Temptation to drop out. There's a temptation to shoot yourself in the foot to get out of the nightmare. There's a temptation just to lie down and never get up again. You're always tempted by it, but in the morning, you'd saddle up and you'd keep humping. And as I mentioned earlier, politics was really not much talked about in Vietnam among guys on the ground. what was talked about was, you know, dear God, here's what we have to do today. We have to cross that river and we have to go up into those mountains. That's what we talked about.
I wanted to ask Aaron a little bit about, I think it's kind of interesting, you know, if you spent 4 years with Tim following him around and he and his family, which I'm encouraging people again to watch this documentary, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien, because his family is just they appear to be a wonderful family. How did you remain, you know, just kind of on the side and just watch this whole thing evolve in front of you?
Well, yeah, I can attest they really are a wonderful family, and that was another incentive for me to do the film, that not only was Tim going to be the central character, but his wife Meredith, his two boys, Timmy and Tad, were not just adorable and charming, but like whip smart and entertaining to listen to and insightful as well. So it was kind of a great opportunity to be able to document this family. And, you know, as you can tell, Tim transfixes you with his language. And it really is how I decided to make this film. In the beginning, I was working another project for PBS about the history of the military draft in America. And I became really interested in the civilian military divide and the consequences of that. And I had interviewed a lot of people about this issue. And I mean, I'm a documentary filmmaker. I've been making films for almost 30 years now. And I interview people for a living, a lot of really smart, articulate, polished people. But after Tim's interview, I just thought, my first instinct was really a selfish one. It was just like, I want to spend more time with this guy, you know, for me, you know, and like that's the beauty of documentary film. You have the excuse of the film to be able to hang around people more. And Tim's way with words was electrifying, you know, and, I think, a lot of people know his words and his books, you know, and I felt there was an opportunity to let people know that there are many other sides to him, and that, you know, there's great, appeal to the kind of, brutal candor that, Tim exhibits, like in his writing and in his talking. And you see that in the film.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I liked the idea of talking with Tim O'Brien to because he kind of puts a face on the more run of the mill veteran that is out there. You know, many of us served in Vietnam because our dads had served in World War II, and we kind of thought, you know, it was expected that's, you know, when the president calls, you go. We didn't know, mm-hmm. you know, most of us didn't know where Vietnam was. We certainly didn't know the history of Vietnam. All we knew is that when we got off that plane, it was the hottest place on Earth, along with the most humidity on Earth combined. And, you know, you're running one way, and these other guys are running the other way to get back on the Freedom Birds and get home.
Right.
And then you try to
figure out. Yeah, that's one of the strong memories I have of arriving in Vietnam, and lined up as we got off the plane, all our uniforms were fresh and dark green and undirtied. And then another line of guys getting on the same damn plane looked as if they just walked out of the, you know, the bowels of hell, filthy, and their faces, you know, that 1,000-yard stare, and kind of looking at us with incredible pity, like, all right, guys, here's what you're in for. It's an indelible memory. I can see it now as I'm saying it. I can picture that line of guys who were going home looking at us with this incredible sense of pity.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I just wanted to ask one last question, and we'll wrap this up. We were talking with Tim O'Brien and Aaron Matthews about the new documentary coming out on Tuesday, the 2nd of March, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien. And I want to make sure I remind people that check out Tim's new book, Dad's Maybe Book, which is his stories and legacy to his two two teenage children now. Aaron, you wrote about the draft, or you did a documentary about the draft, and I was curious what you found while you were doing. I have to go watch this now because the draft was just, it was such an important part and a scary part in everything of our lives. I mean, if you were in college, you couldn't really afford to drop out of college because they get, I mean, that's what happened to me. I dropped out of school 6 weeks later. I got my letter and, you know, the rest is history, as they say. What did you learn in making that documentary?
Well, the biggest thing that the draft opened up my eyes to was how many Americans live in a kind of social and political bubble about war, you know, and how numb we are as a nation to war. And I think in large part that has to do with the elimination of the draft, which is, you know, a longer story. But that was my big takeaway, that, you know, me included, I don't come from a military family. I did not serve. And I realized this was like 6 or 7 years ago when I started working on the draft, that I was also kind of, you know, had this like shoulder shrug attitude about America's engagement in war, and that it was wrong on so many levels, that it was just grossly unfair. And kind of grappling all with that subject matter compelled me to read more and learn more about it, and that's when I met Tim, and I realized, like, okay, here's a guy who woke me up to the injustice of all this, and would be like an indispensable experienced guide to kind of answering and exploring these deep questions that I had about war and its after effect. So that was my way in. You know, that's what the draft did. It just kind of like opened my eyes to a subject matter that I felt was like that Americans should be much more attuned to. You know, we are a nation at war, and we as a people don't wrestle with it. And I saw in Tim someone who was openly wrestling with it and able to kind of synthesize and crystallize that issue for the rest of the country.
Well, I totally agree with that. And I think that many of the Vietnam veterans that I know are still wrestling with that whole question of, you know, wars that aren't, you know, not wars that are not necessary. And I'm not going to get off on a political discussion here, but it's just It drives you crazy. When we think about this, and now we've got, you know, less than 1% of the population is in the military. People don't realize that more enlisted personnel were in Vietnam than the draft people were. And, you know, we go back to that stereotype again, and it's unfortunate. And I don't want to end on that kind of note, but I did want to thank Tim for kind of motivating me again to get more, you know, this COVID-19 thing is driving everybody crazy. And we had just started doing a program here in our local area of collecting stories from veterans, where we'd get together at the local VFW and whatever it was. And we started recording things that we called There I Was. And, you know, that's how all war stories start, you know, and I want to get back to that, because the guys that were there started coming back every month for another story. And then they started bringing their spouses with them, and they started bringing their kids with them. Because one of the things that you have pointed out is that most people don't want to necessarily, they want to hear our stories, but they don't want to hear it. And that the idea is that if we tell our stories to our families one time, that's fine. They don't need to hear it anymore. But we need to talk about it more as a veteran. We need to get these things out of our heads, and so we can understand, you know, why we're angry at something, or why we act this way, or why we act that way. So that's my philosophy for the day.
I agree with you that the power of story is amazing. That you don't convince people of anything with abstraction. It doesn't hit the stomach, and doesn't hit the heart, and doesn't hit your liver. It doesn't, but a story can do that. And so when you at the VFW or wherever you're taping people who are talking and telling their stories, it's much more visceral. And I think you learn without the abstraction, without the political overlay and all the contention that we will have politically, but you learn how it feels to, even if you're not drafted, how it feels to worry about getting drafted. Will it happen to me? All across America in our era, all those 50 years ago, families were worried about the mailman coming. Not just the guy who's going to get drafted, but their mothers and their fathers and their sisters and brothers. And now, as Aaron just so eloquently said, that America is excluded from that by and large. And as you mentioned, Dale, that, you know, it's less than 1% of our country has to even worry about our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq on a personal level. They might worry about it in a general, but the wolf isn't at the door for them. And so the weird thing for me is something I hated when I was 21 years old, the draft. Now I'm thinking, well, at least back then, everybody in America was at least subject to the draft. If you were 18 and over and you were male and so on, if you weren't, somebody in your family was. And now it's pretty easy to go to your Elks Club or your Rotary Club and spout your belligerent rhetoric, you know, let's go kill all those elk.
Yes.
Without you doing it, somebody else is going to do it, but you don't have to. Nor does your son. You can put your son safely away at Stanford, you know, and he doesn't have to go to the war. And so now something I hated so much before, I'm never going to love the draft, but it seems a little fairer and a little more democratic than to count on many people who join the military to get an education, to learn a trade, to see the world and so on, and end up, you know, getting their legs blown off for this sort of glamorous image they might have gone to the war with. So I have, like Aaron, I have conflicting feelings about the conscription. I don't want anybody to get drafted. But if we're going to have a war, then the wolf should be at every door and not just those who, you know, volunteer.
Absolutely. And Tim and Aaron, I would love to have you back on Veterans Radio to talk about that. It's a separate story, and it's something that I would love to talk to have you both on there to talk about it. I wish we could all get out of here and go have a little adult beverage and just keep on rolling. But we need to end this. I know. Thank you both very, very much for being on our program today. We've been talking with Tim O'Brien and Aaron Matthews about their new documentary, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien. Tim's new book is Dad's Maybe Book, written to his two young boys.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you both very much. It was such a privilege and an honor to meet both of you. And I hope, as I mentioned, we'll be talking again soon. Thank you very much. And thank all the people that helped arrange this interview. I appreciate it very much. Thank you both. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Tim O'Brien and Aaron Matthews, and I hope you get an opportunity to watch the documentary, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien. We're going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have Phil Wyckoff with the Michigan War Dog Memorial. So stay tuned. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Staff Sergeant Drew Dix was working on a CIA project near Cambodia when the Tet Offensive began. Details after this. Dix's mission was to coordinate intelligence gathering with a unit made up mainly of indigenous Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Chinese Hmongs. In late January, Dix and his men were operating with part of a SEAL platoon to get information about a rumored Viet Cong offensive. On January 31st, Dix's unit returned to base to find the Tet Offensive had begun and the city had been overrun. When they tried to land, they encountered heavy fire.
One SEAL was killed, the others pulled out, leaving Dix with only a handful of indigenous soldiers. He moved through the city, picking up pockets of friendly soldiers. His first mission was to rescue an American nurse. Then he brought several CIA employees to safety. Dix and his men moved through the city in an effort to liberate it. He assaulted a building alone in the face of heavy fire to rescue two Filipinos. He killed six Viet Cong and brought out the men. Dix and his men fought through the night, taking back the hotel, theater, embassy house, and other buildings. On February 2nd, after 56 hours of battle, the city was freed. Dix's men had killed an estimated 200 VC. He was presented the Medal of Honor by President Johnson on January 16th, 1969.
Are you a veteran or a military spouse interested in starting or growing an existing business? Then you want to connect with VetBiz Central, Michigan's only veteran business resource center, providing free one-on-one business counseling services, including research plans and preparing veterans to be lender ready. If you're in business, VetBiz Central offers comprehensive strategic marketing strategies to help you connect to corporations. They are one of 20 centers nationwide devoted to veteran business development through the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Veteran Business Development. Vets helping vets. Visit their website at vetbizcentral.org. Or call 810-767-VETS.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and we're going to go straight to our interview with Phil Whiteloff. Phil is the executive director and founder of the Michigan War Dog Memorial.
We want to welcome on the spotlight today a member of the Association of Michigan Military Organization, or AMMO. Veterans Radio America has a partnership with AMMO to bring you a quick look at a Michigan military organization that supports the history of military service here in the state of Michigan. And we encourage you to visit AMMO on Facebook and this particular organization by visiting its Facebook site and website, and go out and visit it this year. So we want to welcome to Veterans Radio the Michigan War Dog Memorial, the president, Phil Whiteloff. Phil, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. I'm honored.
Well, you've been here many times before, but this time you get to be here for the spotlight that we do with AMMO. So let's start with that. Tell our Veteran Radio listeners, Phil, a little bit about the Michigan War Dog Memorial.
Yeah, the Michigan War Dog Memorial was developed about 10 years ago, and it all started with somebody mentioning to me that there was an old abandoned pet cemetery that had a big gray monument with words on it of the war dog. And so I went to take a look at it one afternoon. And as I got to the corner where it's, they told me it was at, I didn't see anything but a heavy wooded area. So I'm with my companion, my German Shepherd, Cody. We walked into the woods, and sure enough, there was that big monument. And as I looked around, I could see these flat headstones popping up through the heavy brush and knee-high grass. And I did one of those things a lot of people have probably done. I stood there and looked around, and I said, you know, somebody should do something about this.
Famous last words.
So we left, and I got home, and I had recently retired. So I'm sitting there one morning having coffee, and I'm thinking about it, you know. All of a sudden, I kind of thought to myself, I said, well, hell, Whiteloff, why don't you do something about it? So I gathered up a lot of my veteran buddies and some canine supporters, and I said, let's go out there and start cleaning that place up. You know, there's a lot of pets buried out there, and people, they're loving pets, and it's a shame that this thing has been abandoned for so many years. So we started cleaning it up. And to be honest with you, it kind of took a life of its own. The more we did, the more we wanted to do. It took us 2 years to totally clean it up. Most of it was manual work. But I was just blessed with having just an army of volunteers that would come. The first day it was going to have a cleanup, I was hoping to get 10 to 12 guys there and gals. And instead, I had 55 people show up. And that, as you know, when you ask for volunteers, you never know what you're going to get. But I was just elated at the support that we got. And we just continued that. We set different Saturdays, and we'd all gather out there and start cleaning and take a grid at a time until we got it all done. It's a whole two-acre plot. So, and once we got it all done, that's when the conversation came up among us. It says, you know, it's already a cemetery. Why don't we start honoring our military dogs? The ones that pass away, let's give them a burial out here. And so one word led to another, and we kind of sat down and says, well, okay, let's do that. Let's rename the whole site. So we renamed it, filed the name, and started a nonprofit organization as the Michigan War Dog Memorial, Inc. And that's when it started. In 2013, we had our first burial of MWD Buddy. He was actually with the Homeland Security at the airport. And that was our first burial. And since then, we haven't turned 45 canine heroes out there. So that's the kind of way it started.
Well, like so many of these members of AMMO, it does just take a core group of men and women who said, you know, let's do something. And you've done something over the last 7 years to 8 years now.
Yeah.
The Michigan War Dog Memorial, Inc., as you mentioned, is a nonprofit organization that people can support with their donations. Tell us where they might go, what website they might go to find out more about the Michigan War Dog Memorial.
Well, there's two places you can go. We have a real nice website that lists actually all the burials that we've done with the picture of the dog, and sometimes we have some history with it. But then go to mwdm.org. That's mwdm.org. And we try to keep that updated as much as we can. And there is a donation button right on that page where you can just hit the button and make us an offer, which would be great. The other place is we're real heavy on Facebook, and it's just under the name of Michigan War Dog Memorial. And we post a lot of things on it. If we're going to have a burial, a ceremonial burial, I'll start posting that probably, you know, a month ahead of time. And we always do all the burials on Saturdays at noon. So that's where they can go to see what we're doing.
And this is really an organization, you know, it's, as I say, it's a nonprofit to educate the general public on the heroics and dedication that canines have given to serve and protect us through the years and years. It really hits at the heart of people who are dog lovers and those who in the military or maybe Homeland Security or police forces really understand the role that these pretty smart animals serve, don't they?
Oh, very much. I mean, you know, if you look back, if you do any kind of research, you'll find that that the canines have been fighting alongside our men and women in uniform ever since World War I. And then if you go into the records, in World War II, they're credited with saving 15,000 lives. In Korea, 3,000 lives. In Vietnam, 10,000 lives. Now, you're already up to 28,000 men and women that would not have come home if it wasn't for a dog. And they went on to fight in Bosnia. They fought in Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, and they're fighting the war on terrorism right now. So these dogs have done their job. And when their time comes, that's our mission. We want to make sure that they are recognized, they're respected, and they're honored on their final journey.
And we're talking to Phil Whiteluff, who's the president of the Michigan War Dog Memorial, Inc., the nonprofit. And I want to point out to everybody, you guys provide this internment with full honors at no cost to the handler or owner, if I understand it right.
That is correct. That is correct. We did not want the handler to be burdened by any financial issues to be able to honor their dog. And this includes the headstone. We take care of the headstone. And again, when we announced what we was going to do, the general public was very encouraging, and we had no problem securing funding for that. And that's how we fund it, is through the donations to make sure that the dog's got, you know, got a real nice headstone and a full ceremonial burial. And when I say full ceremonial, I mean, you know, we start with we got a bagpiper. We have an honor guard. We got 12 German Shepherds escorting the remains to the table of honor. We have a chaplain, an Air Force chaplain, that does the invocation. We do a reading of the bio of the dog. We present the handler with a folded American flag. We play taps on the bugle. And then we have the canine salute team. They do what they call a salute to their fallen comrade. And one of the dogs will come out of the pack, and he will howl for a good 30 seconds. It's called the final salute. And then we ended up with a missing dog formation we created. And as the dogs walk in uniform, in unison down the path of honor, one dog breaks away from the pack, comes up by the table of honor, goes behind the stage and disappears as that unit continues down the path with that void there. All that time as that's happening, we're playing the music by Linda Ronstadt of Goodbye, My Friend. And that's when my wife usually passes out the Kleenexes. So.
Well, you can tell veteran radio listeners this is a service of love for these war dogs, and we're glad that we could have Phil on in this spotlight with Ammo.
I want to thank you all for listening to Veterans Radio today. Before we go, I want to make sure we thank our sponsors, National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC, the Eisenhower Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan at eisenhower.com, VetBiz Central, helping veterans, assisting veterans, so forth. Go to vetbizcentral.com. Charles S. Kettle's VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. VVA 310, American Legion Post 46, and VFW Post 423. You can learn more about these organizations at veteransradio.net/our sponsors. Again, I want to thank you all for listening. If you have any comments or questions that you'd like to ask us, please go to veteransradio.net, click on Contact Us, and until next week, you are dismissed.